Larry, let's get started with what's going on between Hezbollah and Israel. We had a preemptive attack on Hezbollah, and Israelis are talking about that. That was successful. Hezbollah is saying that it wasn't achieving anything for Israel. How do you find it right now?
What I'm hearing from some fairly reliable sources, both in Lebanon, as a matter of fact, down around Maryun in the south, and also from Israel, and also from U.S. European Command. These are not official sources in any way. They're just people who talk to me. What I'm hearing is that the 100 plane tanked, that is to say they actually use refueling so they could continue the strikes. F-35 equipped peremptory attacks didn't do all that much damage. They did do a lot of damage to infrastructure and surrounding areas, but that's not the most infrastructure rich region in the first place. So, you know, the Israelis are claiming that, I listened to Netanyahu before he shut everything down, just blacked out everything. You can't get any word in Israel. I listened to him talking about how to his cabinet, how he had done what they did and that it had been marvelously successful. And just the fact that he tightened up and censored everything after that tells me that that's not true. And what I heard is that it's definitely not true, that he might have hit a few missiles, might have hit a few places where they had maybe actually even stage things, as we did, for example, as any military does that's fairly sophisticated. You put things out that look like missile launchers. You put things out that look like drones on the ground, and all they are is paper mache or whatever. And, you know, planes can't tell the difference, so they dive on them, drop their bombs, shoot their rockets and such. I just don't know. But I suspect it wasn't as devastating as Netanyahu said it was, because I don't believe he would have put the blackout in place so quickly had it been. And that goes for the military, too. They can't talk. They can't talk about it. They can't speak about it. They can't go talk to their buddies about it and that sort of thing. And Israel's pretty good at tightening that sort of thing down. On the other side, I think one of the primary reasons he put it on so fast was the effectiveness of the Hezbollah strikes on Israel. So we've got some dead people, and we've got some destroyed military points, and we've probably got some, I'm hearing we may have even some missiles that maybe went astray. I don't know, because Hezbollah has been very good about not hitting anything but military targets. But when you launch so many missiles, sometimes one or two will go astray, or maybe Iron Dome will hit one of them and it'll go somewhere else with the warhead still intact. So I'm hearing that maybe even some civilians were killed. Bottom line being that I don't think anyone is telling the truth about this exchange of fire. And I think that's both sides' position of contentment, if you will, because Hezbollah knows pretty much, I think, what it's not only can it surveil Israel with almost impunity, it can do BDAs, bomb damage assessment. It can take a look and see what it did. So I think Hezbollah is content with what it did because it thinks it's within the status quo performance. That is, I'll escalate a little bit, you escalate a little bit, but not too much. And we'll go back and forth and back and forth, but we're not going to start something that we neither one want. So that's what it looks like to me. The 100 plane strike didn't look like that. It looked like, oh, I'm going to send him a signal, blah, 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 blah. Maybe he did send him a signal. I don't know. But I don't think he did a whole lot of damage. I don't think he did any damage to speak of to their real capability, because mostly what they shot was Katyushas. They didn't shoot their big guns or even their medium guns. So I think this is a tempest in a teapot in some ways, except for the dead people on both sides, probably. And maybe that's what both sides wanted. Netanyahu wants to make it look like he did more than he did. Hezbollah maybe wants to make it look like they did more than they did. Okay, we're all in good shape now. The more serious matter is what we just did. We picked up from Egypt and we're moving to Doha. And that's just another way of saying diplomacy has failed, and we're going to take a break, and we're going to make sure the break includes a different country. And we're going to buy ourselves some time, and we're going to resume the talks in Qatar. This is really kind of indicative of where we are. We're nowhere. And that's not good. There's certain things operating here. One is Harris's need to approach the election with at least some positive news about Gaza, about Israel, at least something. A ceasefire and a hostage exchange would be euphoria. And she's got to have something like that, I think, to get the kind of kick that she needs to put her over the hurdle, so to speak. And second, they need something in Ukraine. They certainly don't need to be seen as cut and running, but they need something that maybe Ukraine forces, and that they have to say, oh, okay. I mean, after all, it's Ukraine. They're the party in this that's most concerned. They're the ones dying. She needs those two things for the election. And that's what's driving U.S. policy right now, I think, other than in Israel, Netanyahu, and Tony Blinken being essentially Netanyahu's lawyer.
Yeah. Larry, here is an article from August 22nd that is a Israeli general. He's talking about the situation of the Israeli army and how capable are they in fighting. He says that the picture that he's giving us, he's drawing for us, is so unbelievable when you look at it, and the way he's explaining the situation of the Israeli army. And it seems that even Israeli Minister of Defense, he's agreeing with him on the issue that they're having with their army. How do you find it right now within the Netanyahu administration?
Oh, I think that opinion is pretty close to the truth. And as long as Netanyahu continues on his present course, it's probably got at least a 50-50 chance of being realized. And the United States is not going to let that happen, or it's going to do everything within its power to keep that from happening. When I say everything within its power, and I hope I'm right here, that does not mean putting U.S. ground forces in Israel and taking on the burden of whatever happens. But it does mean making sure that we continue to elongate these negotiations, which is what Bibi wants, and we don't necessarily achieve anything in doing them because that's what he wants and we are acting on his behalf. But at the same time, give the appearance that we are achieving something. And that appearance has to be one that seems real to Iran. It has to be one that seems real to a lesser extent, but I think surely so, Hezbollah, and to the other people who might get involved in this if it were a multi-front conflict that suddenly Israel was facing. That'd be the end of it, I think. That really would be the end of it. If you had multiple fronts, each of which was being to its own degree successful against an already beleaguered IDF, an already reservist run out, that is to say, they're stirring the bottom of the pot, and that portion they're stirring is getting sick and tired of what they're doing and doesn't see any end to it, doesn't see any strategy to it other than Ben-Gavir. And, you know, that's another matter because he's rustling his people together. He's getting them together. He's entering northern Gaza. He's entering with shovels, pickaxes, AR-15s, plenty of ammunition, and he's going to start to settle northern Gaza. That's what we're going to see. We're going to see the settler movement in Gaza, just like we've seen it in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan. We're going to see it in Gaza. That's the ultimate Ben-Gavir plan, if you will. And how far Netanyahu goes along with that, I couldn't say, but I suspect he goes along with it a pretty good way. And that's what's going to happen. And that's what Netanyahu needs space to allow to begin to happen so that as it developed in the West Bank, it's irretrievable. You can't bring it back. At least you've got a third of Gaza before anybody stops you and before anybody tries to bring you back. International community, the United States or whatever. And you've seen how feckless the United States has been in the West Bank, for example. So there are a whole lot of forces that are playing right now. I think the major ones are Netanyahu does not want a ceasefire. He does not want to stop the peace talks have picked up from Egypt and moved to Qatar, where they'll be just as unsuccessful, probably, I'm sad to say. And every day that goes by that they are unsuccessful is another day for Netanyahu to implement what he thinks is his strategy, which is destroying Hamas completely and resettling Gaza himself.
Yeah. What we're witnessing from the behavior of Iran together with Hezbollah, it seems that they don't have any sort of tendency to escalate the situation between them and Israel. Do you think they're feeling that Israel is losing? Israel cannot continue this type of attitude? That's why they're not trying to escalate?
I think there's some truth there to what you just said. Look at it from their position. They are looking at Israel killing itself. They're looking at Israel, what would you call it? State suicide. That's what they're looking at. There is every probability that will come to fruition. I'd say right now there's a 60% probability that Israel will kill itself. So why risk your own forces, risk your own state livelihood, for example, by bringing the United States in? Because if you're perceived to be the person causing that and not Israel itself, then the United States is going to come in. We've said that categorically. We're going to take, if Iran attacks or Hezbollah attacks in a significant way that might truly accelerate the destruction of Israel, which I think they could do, we'll come in and we'll prevent that. But if Israel goes of its own accord, so to speak, we won't wake up until it's happened. And there's not much we can do then. I don't think we're going to put divisions on the ground in Israel to defend a state that is absolutely incapable of defending itself and, moreover, has been the cause of its demise itself. So that's a real bad situation for the Jewish state of Israel, which I've said, a Jewish state is dangerous for Jews. Very dangerous for Jews, especially in that region. I would say that about a Jewish state anywhere. If they move to Arizona, I would say a Jewish state is not a liberal democracy. Therefore, you are anathema to what we say we stand for, what Europe stands for, and what the better part of the world, in my view, stands for. And that's liberal democracy. A Jewish state cannot be a liberal democracy because it cannot do anything about its apartheid status.
Can you understand the behavior of Turkey right now? What they're trying to do, in your opinion?
That's a good question. 1 minute Erdogan and his foreign minister seem like they're ready to get on the railing and, start launching rockets and bombs and flying airplanes. And the next minute, they're selling them more oil. So, who can tell what Turkey's going to do and when it's going to do it? I do think one thing is for sure, though. I think Turkey is not long for NATO. I think we will hear the announcement not too long into the future where Turkey decides it's going to go its own way. My huge question about Turkey is it going to go to neutrality? Is it going to go to the BRICS in a formidable, organized way and add tremendously to their weight? Or is it going to go to some kind of neutrality? Is that what I said first? Get myself confused. I just don't know. I've been looking at this for 20 years, actually longer than that. Used to have some really some heavy discussions with people like Powell and like others at the State Department and within the military too about how reliable was Turkey for the future, particularly when the EU started stiffing them. Every time Turkey would make an overture to be a member of the European Union and they would get it put off and put off and put off, we all started talking about it because we all knew that one of the most important members of NATO was Turkey, if not the most important member of NATO, certainly on the southern flank. We couldn't say that Turkey would be around as a NATO member for that much longer because we saw what was happening.
If they finally go with that decision to get out of NATO, in your opinion, what would be the main reason for that? Is that the situation with Gaza and Palestine? Is that the situation with their interest when it comes to getting closer to China and Russia?
I think it would be a combination of all, but I think fundamentally they are a country that thinks of their fundamental security interests, unlike the United States. And I would have to say these days, unlike a lot of European countries too, they're not thinking about their fundamental national security interests. They're thinking about the headlines and the news, and they're thinking about, you know, oh, Putin, the sanctity of borders has been threatened. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. They're not thinking, just not thinking. Turkey's thinking all the time. And I suspect it's going to be based on what I would call self-interest. You can call them enlightened self-interest, whatever, but it's going to be based on their fundamental security interest. And let's face it, the sweep of history is toward the east, not toward the west. The magnet of that sweep is China and India to a certain extent. There's another country that we talk about all the time. Where is India going? Where will India ultimately wind up? Will she continue to play this game of Russia tomorrow, U.S. the next day, Russia the next day, BRICS, you know, will Modi or whomever happens to be the Indian leader keep trying to stay more or less neutral, but to trade with and to function with and to do diplomacy with everyone that counts? Or will they one day make up their minds to side with some group? The biggest impediment there, we have always agreed, military professionals, is China is not beloved of India, nor the other way around. So that would be a real step for them to take to become a substantive member of the Shanghai group or the BRICS or whatever we want to call it. But those are the key decisions in the next 10 to 20 years that will confirm or maybe deny for a while this incredible shift of power away from the West toward the East. You know, we looked at 2,000 years of that power shifting away from the East to the West, starting, you could say, with Columbus's trip to the New World and all the things that followed that, the Spanish rape of so much of the New World for all the gold they got and everything. That's when the power shifted that way. Well, the power's shifting the other way now. It's pretty much clear to me anyway that the power is shifting the other way. Where are these powers that have been aligned with the West, sometimes reluctantly, where are they going to go? Are they going to go into neutrality, or are they going to go with this shift to the East? And the shift to the East inevitably is the magnet of that is China. Now, here's the question in my mind, being somewhat of a Chinese aficionado. Does China realize this to the extent that it's happening? And are they fashioning their strategy to take advantage of that in what I would call a collaborative, cooperative, and less than inimical way? Because that's kind of the way China operated 3,000 years ago. They didn't want to kill everybody. You know, well, you got Genghis Khan and the hordes that came and did a good job of killing. But basically, they traded and they made money, and others traded and made money with them. And so is that China's future, or is it a more bellicose future? And I think that's the question of the 21st century. Which way is China going to go in that terms? And here's the bad thing, I think, about our policy. We're doing just about everything we possibly can to make them go the hard route. And that's not good. It's not good for us. It's not good for Europe. It's not good for the rest of the world. It would be better to let this shift take place and let the American empire find a glide slope on which it can gently slide down to Paris inter pares, if you will, you know, equals amongst equals, rather than trying to maintain primacy. The biggest mistake we're making right now is trying against all odds to maintain primacy. First of all, we've lost it, so we're not going to maintain it for sure. And second, it's eating our lunch physically and security-wise. It's eating our lunch.
There is a new interview, J.D. Vance Trump's pick for vice president, he says to Bill O'Reilly on his show, he says that the European Union should focus on the war in Ukraine while the US priority is China. You know, it's unbelievable how they're not thinking of putting an end to that conflict. They're trying in his mind, he's thinking that we can continue that conflict if European Union helps us to.
I hope the Europeans are smart and tell him to go to hell. There's just no way that that would be a sane decision for them. I suspect it would cause them to start falling apart almost instantly if suddenly main powers like Germany, France, Britain, although I hesitate to call that island nation, which I was beloved of me and my wife for 25 years. We went there every year. Now I don't even recognize it, but I hesitate to call it a power. You could fit their military in a thimble. They've just eviscerated their defense capability while doing some things that were really stupid with regard to it. But I would hate to see those countries embroiled once again in what I would call a historically typical European Donnybrook, trying to figure out what they were going to do once the United States, and that's what JD's really saying. That's what he's saying, withdraws. That's what he's saying. He's covering it with, we're withdrawing so we can take on the bigger power in the world for you. Yeah, right.
Larry, what's your take on what has happened in Bangladesh? We had some sort of color revolution there. It seems that the government was pro-India, and Bangladesh is part of Belt and Road Initiative of China. And it seems that it makes some sort of feeling for China and India to cooperate on this issue. And what's your take on what has happened there?
I think they're really confused right now. I go back to Operation Sea Angel when the Marines were coming back from the first Iraq war, and all of a sudden that typhoon hit, and they had 200,000 dead people. And so Powell ordered the Marines to go north. They were just south of Bangladesh, and they were picking Bangladeshis out of trees. That's the only way they could survive, because the water was 15 feet high. And they would climb 17, 18 feet up in a tree. And that's where the Marines found some of them, pulled them out of the trees, and got them on the boats and fed them. Bangladesh has, in other words, far greater problems and challenges than finding a government that can be stable and that can get along with both India and China. And those problems are going to haunt them throughout this century, to the point where maybe they're going to lose a third, maybe even half their country, as the seas come up. So they need to get out of this business of not being able to find a government that they can tolerate for very long. But it's sort of the same problem Pakistan has on the other end. They don't seem to be able to get their act together politically either, even when the country is flooded by glaciers coming at them. A third of the country was flooded. Even had a military officer in the Pakistani military tell me that India was no longer the number one threat. That bowled me over. He said, the water coming down on us is the number one threat. That'll last as long as the water is coming down on you. Then you'll go back to India. But Bangladesh and Pakistan really have some of the same problems. And they play the giants off against one another, including us, when they need us to play off against China or India, repeatedly. And their governments do that. One government will be, you know, playing China. The other government will be playing India. And then they'll decide they're not going to play either one. They're going to be independent or whatever. And it doesn't work because you're squeezed in between two giants. So that's Bangladesh's real problem. And it's Pakistan's real problem, too, if you think about it for a minute. Although Pakistan, you know, they got a bigger population than Russia. It's a huge, huge country in terms of people. And I don't know how either country, Bangladesh or Pakistan, is going to make it through the 21st century. I hate to say something that dismal, but I don't know how they're going to make it. Water, heat, floods. It's just going to be, you know, once the glaciers go up there, that's Western India, and it's also Pakistan. And Pakistan will make an effort to stop that water and hold on to it as long as it can. And India will, you know, they'll be at each other's throats again over not just Kashmir, but over Indians in the western part of India not having any water. Same problem is going to happen, as it is happening right now, with the Tigris and Euphrates, and what's happening with Turkey, and what's happening with Syria, and what's happening with Iraq, and the water. Because they're not going to have it for the rest of this century. It's going to get worse and worse and worse.
We had Modi going to Kiev talking with Zelensky. And today he
hugging
was
talking, him. Hugging him.
Hugging him, yeah. And he was talking about peace talks and some sort of negotiating settlement. But today we've learned that he was talking with Putin as well.
Yeah.
Larry, those preconditions that Putin has put out before the Switzerland summit, that peace summit in Switzerland, it seems that he's achieving all those objectives, all those preconditions without going to any sort of negotiations. This shows how this whole case of Ukraine is unbelievable. And
if I were Putin right now, I might do an Israeli thing. I might halt, give myself about a 30-kilometer buffer zone, and halt and build a big fence and say, okay, over to you guys. I'm through with you. This is my territory. On the other side of the fence is your territory. I've created a buffer, 30-kilometer buffer for you, artillery range buffer, and I don't want to see you again. I don't want to deal with you. I don't want to talk to you. Go away. Go away. If you send anything over my way, I'll send five your way. So, you know, what was it Lavrov said this morning? I was listening to Lavrov, and he said, a brilliant statement, really. He said, Americans think that if a war goes nuclear, it'll be confined to Europe, or words like that in Russian. Think about that for a minute. Americans think that if a war goes nuclear, it'll be confined to Europe. It'll be on European soil. Pick up the parentheses there. It won't. And Putin was saying the same thing when he was talking about his triad being better than our triad. You know, the ballistic missile submarines, the bombers, and the ballistic missile submarines, and the ballistic missiles themselves. We and the Russians are the only ones of the nuclear weapons owning states that have a triad, three parts to it. And he said, our triad's better than your triad. All of Sergei's and Putin's remarks about nuclear weapons have been sane, cogent, correct, and aimed to scare. And, you know, I'd be doing the same thing if I were dealing with this kind of imbecility and deception and duplicity in Europe and Washington. He doesn't have much choice but to do that. I'm not trying to defend him. I'm just saying that he's the sane member here. He's the sane person. And I think what Modi was doing was probably talking to both about, let's stop this. Let's stop it, because it's not doing you any good, Zelensky. And Putin, you've been at it long enough. You know, you need to stop too, because there are other things you've got to do. And there's other places in the world that we need you to help with. The other aspect of it is, I kind of agree. I was listening to, I think it was Doug McGregor the other day. I was listening to him. And I think he's right. Zelensky stashed probably billions of dollars, and he stashed them in Albania. He stashed them in other places. So Zelensky, if he wants to enjoy that money he's basically stolen, he better get out while he can, because somebody's going to kill him, from the military, from the civilian population. Somebody's going to kill him. That's the way Ukraine operates from time to time. They're one of the most corrupt states in the world anyway. But if he wants to get out with his shirt, so to speak, he better figure a way to get out at the same time he's concluding some sort of ceasefire and peace deal, because they're not going to be very happy with him. I'm hearing right now that there are very powerful elements in Ukraine who already aren't happy with him. I wouldn't be surprised to see him disappear I don't necessarily mean into the grave, but I mean, you know, he'll wake up in Tirana or someplace. If I were he, I'd go further than Tirana.
We have two countries right now that the United States is supporting, Israel and Ukraine. In both of these countries, Larry, we have disagreement within the administration. We have disagreement in Israel, as we talk, between Netanyahu and his Ministry of Defense.
But not between Blinken and Netanyahu. Blinken is Bibi's lawyer. Just want to make that correction.
Yeah. And in Ukraine, we are witnessing right now, it seems that there are serious disagreements between Zelensky and Zersky when it comes to this offensive in the Kursk region. And do you think that the United States is thinking that in the future they can manage these countries, that they're having a lot of problems within the administration? We are not talking about the people outside the administration.
Yeah, you're right. And just this morning, I listened to Rafael Grossi, the head of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Association. He's over in Kursk right now, as I understand it. He's very worried because I didn't know this until he explained it in this interview. Unlike Zaporizhia and the reactor there, the reactor right there in Kursk has no dome on it. It has no protective dome on it. It's just a roof, just a regular old roof. And so a drone or a bomb, an artillery round, could do real havoc with that reactor. And he's very worried about what might happen to it, which is why he's there personally. That's another situation that, you know, we're not thinking about, that this region is fraught with those kinds of problems that could expand everything really quickly, including death and destruction.
Right now, in your opinion, is there any understanding in the European Union about this strategy of the United States in order to, because right now in Europe, when you see the Czech president, he was talking about that Nord Stream pipeline was a legitimate goal for legitimate target for Ukrainians. And then Germany saying, no, that's not the case. And You're not supposed to talk this way. And it doesn't seem, even getting back to J.D. Vance, he was talking about putting the European Union in charge of helping Ukraine. It doesn't seem that we do have any sort of unity within the European Union. Eastern, Western Europe, between Olaf Scholz and Macron, between Czech and Germany.
How would I would want to look at General C.Q. Brown, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, if I were his special assistant, like I was Powell's, and say, General, how are you going to do this? Are you just going to go tell Berlin and Paris and maybe London and a few others? Are you just going to tell them and tell them to communicate to the other 30 members? We're leaving. And we're going to take care of China for you. And we're leaving you with Ukraine. Is that what you're going to do? Is that how you're going to do it? Because I don't see any other way to do it than that. You can't just walk out and suddenly focus on China. All aircraft carriers to the South China Sea immediately. You know, blah, blah, blah. How do you do this? And when you do it, no matter how subtle and kind and gentle you are, the Europeans are going to fall into a mess. A total mess, because the Germans are going to argue with the French with the Germans with the Norwegians, the French with the Belgians. Everybody's going to be at each other's throat. And Viktor Orban and the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic, they're all going to be. You're just not going to do anything but turn loose the dogs of war and argument inside Europe. If we're going to break the transatlantic link, we don't need to do it that way. I think we are ultimately, but we don't need to do it that way. Yeah. That would be nonsense. I don't know what General Brown would say, except maybe I'm going to retire.
Hear what Zelensky said about peace talks, Larry.
Is there a way Is there a plan, strategy perhaps, to consider negotiating and consider perhaps giving up some of Ukraine's territory in exchange for peace and security guarantees? So, for instance, if there is an offer of guaranteed NATO membership, would that be something you would consider to sit down and negotiate and give up territory? Thank you.
Thanks so much. We are not ready to change our territories, and we can't do it to change our territories on any negotiations. Yes, that is the first. It's difficult. Yes, because this decision depends, of course, on support of our colleagues. And I hope that they will do everything further and quicker. You said about F-16. It's a very good result. Very good. Nobody talked about it, but we destroyed already in this huge attack of Russians. We destroyed already some missiles and drones using F-16. I will not share how many, but we did it thanks to partners that they gave us F-16s, provided to us. But again, it's not enough. We're a small number of F-16, and we need to do wider training mission and etc. We have propositions to the United States. It depends on their permission. They have to be positive on it. They have to look at this real. Because we speak about our territories, not about America.
It's unbelievable. He's not.
Yeah. I could only understand about every third word, but I think I got the gist of it. The volume was so low for me.
Yeah. He was talking about that he's not interested to negotiate because this is the Ukrainian territory. It's not the territory right. of the United States that they have to decide about. And he's asking, instead of negotiating, he's asking for more weapons.
Yeah. And I heard the bit about NATO too, which Russia has said is no membership for Ukraine in NATO, no affiliation with NATO, none whatsoever. Has to be neutrality across the board.
So he's talking about F-16 being capable of shooting drones and missiles. And Larry, does it make sense in your opinion?
Not a bit. His latest gambit has turned out to be a disaster. He's lost probably the premier soldiers that he had in his military, and he's lost them for a political stunt to make a headline that Russia, for the first time since 1941, has been invaded, which is bullshit because what kind of invasion was it? And now his people are dying, and they're going to die. They can't even get food and water. They're surrounded. They're in a salient that's cut off. And at the same time that he's losing these best soldiers Ukraine had, they're not where Ukraine is going to fold on the main line, where they're losing people in astounding numbers every day. So he's living in la-la land. And I don't know whether it's purposefully that he's doing this because he's so frightened of what I just said that if he admits to anything else, they'll take him out. Or it's just that he's being given bad advice by people who don't want to tell him the truth. But he's living in la-la land.
As we mentioned before, he doesn't agree with Sersky on some issues. He didn't agree with Zeluzhny. We can understand there is a sense in their army against him and his administration. That would be much more dangerous for him and his position.
Yes, I think so. And one would suspect that would probably be where the revolt, the coup, whatever we want to call it, would come from. But I'm told that he has the one thing he does have sensitive feelers for amongst the group that's relatively loyal to him is if that's imminent. So the sign of that will be his unassing Ukraine, his leaving for one of his dashas, wherever it happens to be. I kind of comparing with Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un, they always had some place in Switzerland or wherever, in case the balloon went up and it looked like North Korea was going to disappear from the face of the earth, they had a place to go. Well, I think Zelensky does too. And it's well oiled with U.S. money. I should say U.S. and European money.
Just to wrap up this session, Larry, do you think that this offensive, this attack on the Kursk region is changing Russia's strategy toward Ukraine?
No, I do not. I think it tactically made them do some things, and it was a surprise. There's no question about it. I think part of the reason it was a surprise was because it was so stupid. You don't expect your opponent to surrender his strategic reserve to you for killing. You expect to have to go deep into his territory to get to his strategic reserve. He offered it to them on a plate. So now they're going to take their time and they're going to eliminate it. They already are doing that. And meanwhile, they're pressing hard on the main front, which is the thing that's critical to Putin. The thing that's keeping this going, Nima, in my view, the thing that's keeping this going, and Zelensky doesn't know this, I hope he's listening to us, is the election in the United States. That's what's keeping it going. The moment the election is decided, and that might not be a moment, because I'm listening to all kinds of things that are going to happen. You know, the state of Texas is right now passing laws where they can tell people at the polls, we don't trust you. We're going to give you a provisional ballot. You can vote, but it'll be on this provisional ballot. And then, of course, they're planning on throwing the provisional ballots away. This is Texas is doing this right now under Governor Abbott. They're doing this. So it might take a while before we determine who the winner of the election is. But once that's done, Zelensky's toast. Ukraine is toast as far as the United States is concerned, because we'll put the hammer lock on him immediately to get it shut down. And one thing we are serious about, I think, from what I've gleaned, we're serious about finally pivoting to China. What worries me about that is that we pivot so strongly and so inexpertly and so idiotically that we do exactly what I've feared for so long. We do make China a real bellicose enemy, and they'll hand us our rear end. But no one will win, because we'll go nuclear. No one's going to win a war between the United States and China. And we probably will initiate the use of nuclear weapons, because we'll be the ones conventionally losing.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great Surely. Pleasure as always.
Surely. Love your new system.